Hi there. Welcome to Spectrum West, everyone. I'm Al Ross. Mid-September already. We'll be seeing Christmas ads on TV pretty soon. Wow. This is where people come to meet with artists and artisans, musicians, composers, entertainers, writers, and others who, by their deeds and energy, add to the rich culture of Western Wisconsin. Today, it's time for fall art tours. We'll go in-depth on one and articulate details on others. Bacon is beautiful, so beautiful, in fact, it gets its own festival this weekend in River Falls. We have an insider's look. It wasn't easy settling Wisconsin in the Midwest. Jim Oliver is here with a Wisconsin author who's written many books about our predecessors, and they'll focus on her newest, about pioneer living through the seasons of the upper Midwest. Jim also glances at what's on stage in this vast artistic patch of Wisconsin. And this version of Spectrum West germinates right here. When Andrew Carnegie donated millions towards building libraries in America, I'm wondering if he ever imagined how far libraries would have to evolve to compete with information that today is literally at our fingertips. Today, libraries lend other things, not just books, audio, video, and the like. The L.A. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire includes seeds in that concept. Borrow seeds, grow something, harvest the seeds, and lend the new generation back to the library. It's the Eau Claire Grows Community Seed Library, and Issa Small is the library's programming and communications services manager. It began back in April, which was planting season, of course. Mm-hmm. You had a good turnout then. And like, which came first, the chicken or the egg? This had to start with seeds.
It did, yes.
And you got the seeds in Iowa.
All of the seeds were purchased from the Seed Savers Exchange, which mm-hmm. is located in Decorah, Iowa, the largest seed-saving network in the world. Mm. And all of their seeds are heirloom-tested to make sure that they are true to type, and they are, in many cases, very old seeds.
The Adam and Eve of this program, aren't they?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, I actually came across the idea of a seed library while attending a library conference a couple of years ago, mm-hmm. and the La Crosse Public Library had just started theirs, and I just happened to be having lunch with a few of the ladies that were working on it, and I thought it sounded like such a unique program and a way to really help the community in a way that I think we see it. It needs help.
Back in April, I read that there were 200 people interested and then 46 households checked out
mm-hmm.
400 packets of seeds initially.
Yep.
Now, impressively, though, this has grown to over 200 households and over 1,200 seed packets.
Yeah, we've been really pleased with the response. Many of the households have checked out one of each of the 16 varieties. Some only take a couple. So it was really interesting to me because we had a couple of varieties like arugula and eggplant that I wasn't sure if people were going to be interested in those. Mm-hmm. But actually, it was a lot of families, children picked them out and they said, I want to grow these. And the parents would say, okay, but you're going to have to eat them when they're grown. And they said, okay, I will.
Mm-hmm. Eat your vegetable. You know, and this is about to go full circle. Checkouts are going to become, probably have started becoming deposits now. We know about mm-hmm. responsibilities when borrowing a book. What are the rules of this exchange?
Well, the hope is that as the growing season comes to an end, folks will save their seeds, and mm-hmm. we did provide handouts for each of the varieties on how to go about doing that.
So it's just a hope? There's no commitment? They don't sign anything?
No absolute commitment to it. We hope that people will return them so that we can keep this program going, but there aren't going to be any negative repercussions for not returning seeds because we understand that things like if my tomatoes didn't grow well, I may not have seeds to return or something like that.
See, I thought this was like ironclad. Like the police were going to show up at your front door if you didn't bring any seeds back.
There is no seed police.
So you don't have to bring back the same number you borrowed?
Nope.
None of that. Okay.
Nope. We hope that you keep some for yourself to grow next year.
Can people deposit without having been a borrower?
Sure. We will take any seeds. We'd like them to be properly labeled. We'll want to know which variety they are, not only that they're a tomato, but which variety. They may not be part of the collection that we track what's coming and going, but we will certainly make them available to other community members.
And you can sort of tell seeds by looking at them what mm-hmm. they what they are. Do you also provide care of planting and that kind of stuff? Does other information accompany the seeds when they check them out?
Yep. The seed packet itself actually has a small label on it that tells, you know, how to get the seed started, when to plant it, and a little bit on how to save the seeds, and also a little bit about the variety, you know, if it's good for cooking or better to eat fresh, that kind of thing.
So you mentioned some of the vegetables that have been popular. Is that the only kind of seeds? And I would guess that now after the first season, it's going to kind of explode and you'll have
this
wide range?
This season we started with easy to grow, easy to save. So they're ones that hopefully you should just need to plant and water and keep an eye on them and they'll grow well.
Mm-hmm.
But they're also easy to save, meaning not only are they easy, the seeds, you can gather them and return them, but also that there isn't too much to worry about as far as which vegetable you plant next to which other vegetable as far as cross-pollination. But next year, we'll get into more of the advanced seeds like carrots and cucumbers and that kind of thing.
Are there real meticulous instructions on how to save and dry seeds?
It depends on what kind of seed that you're trying to save. So the ones that we went with this year are pretty much the really simple ones like what you were talking about. There are ones that are a little more advanced.
In the studio with Issa Small, she is Programming and Communication Services Manager at the L.E. Phillips Memorial Public Library in Eau Claire. They have a seed library. This is the first year. Borrowing, Issa, is just the tip of the iceberg. The library, as I saw, also hosts some other programs designed to focus on healthy lifestyles. You just had a couple of programs.
Yep. We started out this fall. One of our first programs for our fall lineup was Healthy Eating on the Run. And there were a couple of health educators from Mayo Clinic Health System kind of walking through. There are a lot of busy families that may have just a few minutes or half an hour in between getting home from work and off to the next sporting event.
Mm-hmm.
So kind of looking at in the time that you have, what are the best choices that you can make. And a lot of that includes fresh vegetables and fruit and that kind of thing. So it kind of all comes back to the seed library. And then we went kind of a different way where if you have a little bit more time, a naturalist from the Beaver Creek Reserve coming in to do a program on foraging for wild edibles. So as you're going through all of our lovely trails and you look upon a if you've ever looked upon a plant and wondered, geez, can I eat that?
Yes, yes.
This may be the program for you. And that will be coming up later this month.
Everyone needs that. I remember going once to dinner at some people's home, and they were having steak, and they were having mushroom sauce. And they said, oh, yeah, we were just out picking these mushrooms this afternoon. And I went, okay, let's see how much I trust these people.
Yeah.
Because that's a tough one for me. I've never picked a mushroom and eaten it in my life. There's so many of them out there.
Yeah.
Foraging, I think that's a good word. That's a great word. That's a word that humans ought to do more often.
Yeah, yeah, just kind of get out there and put your knees in the mud and dig around. And
I mean, animals have to, so why wouldn't we forage?
Yeah.
As you mentioned, though, this is such a great lesson for and a skill for kids. I mean, you borrow, you plant, you nurture, you enjoy, and then you return.
Mm-hmm.
Does this cover the gamut, or is there a kid's version of a seed library?
I think it's really intended to be an all-ages program. And a lot of what we've seen at our library, and I know they've seen it at La Crosse as well, is it's a really great family activity. Parents really enjoy it because it not only gets the kids to eat their vegetables, but it gets them to look forward to doing chores like watering the plants and pulling weeds and that kind of thing, and even taking part in cooking and cutting up the tomatoes that they planted.
And there's also that residual effect when kids are excited about coming in and checking out seeds or coming in and tell you about how their seeds went or bringing seeds back. They're in the library.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that we did do at our open house is we kind of gathered a lot of our materials and resources that we thought might be helpful for folks starting a live seed garden. So in addition to just regular gardening books, we also had things on how to have organic gardening or, you know, how to cook with fresh produce and that kind of thing. So we've got a lot of supplementary materials to go along with that.
Organizations and forward-looking entities seem to be coming up with innovative ways to interest people in things that, because of the way technology is, because of our lifestyle, our pace, seem to be waning a little bit. This seed library is a wonderful idea. I mean, I can't think of anything better. Are there other innovative programs down the way where librarians are thinking of things that you could check out, physical things other than books?
Oh, absolutely. We're looking into a number almost constantly.
Mm-hmm.
But I know that there are libraries that will lend tools, you know, you can go out and trim your bushes or cut down a tree. There are also libraries that will lend cake pans so you can make a special birthday cake for your son or daughter and not have to commit to that money. You know, they may not care about that character next year when their birthday rolls around. So libraries are lending hotspots. I know that's kind of goes along with the expanded technology. So, yeah, there's a lot of different things that libraries can do to help the community live their lives.
That brings to mind, are you regulated in any way about lending things to people?
With regards to the seed library, we are through the Wisconsin Department of Agricultural and Consumer Trade Protection.
Okay.
I have a license to repackage seeds. So next year I'll have to look into a different type of license as we have seeds that have been returned to us. It's not just going to repackage seeds. We're going to distribute those. So we'll have a different license. As far as some of the other types of things, I don't know if there are regulations on them, but there are certainly liabilities that would have to be considered.
So that was what I was going to bring up next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, with this litigious society we have today, getting back to the innovation of people, we've depended on our neighbor for the longest time.
Mm-hmm.
Can somebody borrow a cup of sugar?
Yeah, not from the library.
Well, the word borrow is an interesting word. It's a word that I think people used to do a lot more borrowing than
mm-hmm.
they do now.
I have never asked my neighbor to borrow a cup of sugar.
Never?
Never.
Well, congratulations.
Well,
the seed library is a wonderful idea. Most popular varieties, what were those that were checked out?
Basil, sunflower, and tomatoes.
Not necessarily in that order.
No.
Wonder why basil? I guess that's such a universal herb.
Yeah, it's a pretty popular herb. Just about anybody can use that in a number of dishes.
So we would think that if sunflowers is up there in the top three, eventually we'll see a ton of sunflowers.
Hopefully.
Growing all over.
Mm-hmm.
Working with nature, the organic landscaping program. Tell me about that.
Gordon Petchow came and did a presentation on organic lawn care. He has been in the lawn care industry for a long time,
mm-hmm.
And he talked about how to work with nature rather than dumping chemicals to try to fight it. So we did a program to help folks understand the type of soil that they're working with and how best to use that to get it to grow whatever it is they're wanting to grow, rather than just continuing the cycle of chemical after chemical after chemical.
Yeah, so we're going to look forward to your introduction of all these new ways of borrowing things. You
Absolutely.
Said you're working on some things.
Yeah, we've got a couple in the hopper.
It's a progressive library.
I like to think so.
Great
yes.
place to work?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
Yes.
You've been there a while.
I have.
Issa Small, thanks.
Thank you.
Anyone can count the seeds in an apple. The magic is the number of apples in a seed. The Ellie Phillips Memorial Public Library will watch the seed library as it grows. You know, bacon's so good it gets its own festival, and it could be America's biggest celebration in River Falls. That's coming up. This is Spectrum West, and support for WPR comes from the Minnesota Marine Art Museum in Winona. The MMAM presents 10 exhibitions per year and has masterpieces by Picasso, Van Gogh, Monet, and many more. Visit and support information at mmam.org. Support also comes from Luther College, a liberal arts college that emphasizes learning in community to instill research, writing, and critical thinking skills, and an environmental and service ethos. Visit information at luther.edu. Well, Jim Oliver, a pair of weeks ago, trialogued with some people involved in the life and times of Laura Ingalls Wilder, a Wisconsin pioneer. And today, Mr. Oliver introduces us to another writer with more contemporary Wisconsin ties, but also with a focus on the way we were.
Kathleen Ernst is a Wisconsin author who writes both for adults and for children. In August, a nonfiction book, A Settler's Year, Pioneer Life Through the Seasons, was released by the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. Kathleen Ernst joins us by telephone from her home in Middleton to talk about this book and any other books we can get her to talk about. Welcome to Spectrum West.
Well, thank you so much. I'm delighted to join you today.
Well, according to your autobiography, you wrote your first novel when you were 15, but didn't get a book contract until 20 years later.
That is correct. I was not technically an overnight success.
But you obviously achieved success, not necessarily overnight, but over time, because you now have three different publishers. Now, how did that come about?
See, I think I've worked with seven publishers over the years now since that first publishing contract came through. I needed that time to learn my craft and to learn about the ever-changing publishing industry, so I just kept at it. And fortunately, I love to write. I love to tell stories. So if there are any writers out there who are wondering whether they should give it a try or not, my recommendation is if you love to write and that's something you enjoy doing, then go for it, because it's a wonderful hobby until it might turn into something else. And for me, the first publishing contract that came along was from a small press that was interested in one of my historical novels for teens. And I got started writing for children and young adults and went in that direction for quite a while. But I've always wanted to write both for adults and children, and so fortunately I've been able to do so in my career.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about the research that went into A Settler's Year. It's divided up into seasons, and some of it is heartbreaking and some of it's very uplifting, and you have some very poignant stories to tell. Where did you get all this information?
Well, I've actually been compiling stories about immigrants in Wisconsin and the upper Midwest for many years. I moved to Wisconsin in the early 1980s specifically to take a job at Old World Wisconsin, the state's outdoor ethnic museum in Waukesha County. And I've become just very fascinated with the experiences of everyday men and women and children who made such a tumultuous move either from New England states or especially from Europe crossing the Atlantic. Every story is different. Every person's story is unique. So I have spent quite some time, and then especially when I started on this book, really digging into their accounts to the extent that I could, looking for diaries and letters and reminiscences and interviews and other stories that have been preserved, sometimes within family histories, thinking about them. And as I approach the book, the basic structure of the book, as you said, it's organized in a sort of a calendar cycle so that we get a glimpse of what it was like for people living on farms or in rural small towns in the 1800s and early 1900s. And as I was thinking about that and collecting quotations and accounts that I wanted to use, I also sort of thought about how the agricultural year really reflected, sort of as a metaphor, of the overall cycle that many immigrants experienced from starting sometimes with absolutely nothing in the very early years of settlement, and that was sometimes a very brutal and challenging experience, and working hard, and most people finally got some land of their own, were able to see some success and to see some of their dreams come true, and that's another wonderful cycle that I think readers will take away from the book.
There was a mention of education and schooling at that time. Talk a little bit about how children were educated in those days.
Well, in the earliest days, often it was done within communities. If there were several families in an isolated part of Wisconsin, perhaps they might band together and either one parent would teach the local children, or perhaps they could manage to hire a young girl, 14, 15, 16, to teach. Children also had a lot of responsibilities on the farm, and so they attended school really when the agricultural cycle permitted them. So often children went to school in the summer after the frenzy of spring planting, and then in the winter, which was a quieter season for most families. And so there are some accounts of children walking to school 6 miles when it was well below zero. And I think that reflects a lot about how so many of the families just really valued the importance of education.
I also found it interesting. I'm old enough to have known people who actually made a living this way. A lot of the people were able to put bread on the table by cutting wood during the winter and selling wood in town. It's a fascinating way to make a living, but I guess that's what they had to do.
That's what they had to do. And in the early years of settlement in the 1830s, 40s, 50s, for some of the newly arrived immigrants from Europe who came really with empty pockets, the wood harvest in the winter actually kept them from starving. Some men cut fence rails, some men cut trees for wood and sold the lumber, some people made shingles. And I think it's important to note, women did this also. Some of them marched out and helped their husbands, and there are also accounts of women who just went out on their own, and their husbands were busy elsewhere if they were married, and this was the only thing they could do to earn money, especially if they arrived in the late summer or fall, which many of the Europeans did. It took a while to get across the ocean and make their way to Wisconsin. So there are some really poignant accounts of women spending these bitter days out in the snow, or children helping their dads, too, if they were the ones who were available to do that. But I also think, in some ways, it did at least give them something to do, because the winters were very long for people that didn't have books to read or wool to spin or neighbors to chat with very often. And I think they welcomed the opportunity to at least get out and do something.
We're talking to Kathleen Ernst, who is author of A Settler's Year, Pioneer Life Through the Seasons. I remember one segment in the book brought back a lot of memories for me as a child, because it talked about the old-timers who would go to a store, sit around the stove and tell stories. We had a place where I grew up just north of us. It was called Estes Brook. Everybody called it Dogtown because all the old dogs came to town.
I think that was a cycle that's been repeating itself many years, and it's easy to imagine for people that spend most of their time on a farm, especially in the years before people had horses, or in some cases even an oxen, and a trip to town, the local crossroads village, was really something very special. So you can settle in and get the news and chat and catch up with neighbors and people from a little bit farther away, and that was really something to be savored.
Tell us about the photos. There are a lot of wonderful photos in the book.
Yes, what we chose to illustrate the book, it's a lavishly illustrated book, and in my introductory essay, those pages are illustrated by historic photos so that we could share a few faces of people in Wisconsin in the 1800s and early 1900s. And then what the press chose to do, the Historical Society Press, was combine my prose and the quotations from immigrants with color photographs that were taken at Old World, Wisconsin. Almost all of them were taken by a wonderful photographer named Lloyd Heath, who has spent years wandering around the site. My job was really quite interesting, because when we began the project, he gave me his database of over 4,000 photos, and I had been collecting the accounts and the quotations that I wanted to use and thinking about themes. So I really approached the photos in a couple of different ways. In some cases, I knew that I wanted a certain photo, perhaps of a man plowing or something like that. But I was also very sensitive to the fact many of the photographs that Lloyd has taken, they tell whole stories themselves. They're very evocative. They really convey a mood and often have a lot to say. So in that case, my job when I was writing a caption or choosing how it'd be placed in the book was really to give it enough space to stand on its own and have a chance to invite readers in to capture all the details, the often sensory details that can be elusive in a book. But I think these beautiful photographs do quite a good job of that.
Well, over the years, your accomplishments have ranged from winning a blue ribbon in a crosscut saw competition to winning an Emmy for an instructional video you produced for public television. Why don't you give us a Cliff Notes version of your background?
Yes, those are two highlights, I should say. Well, my undergraduate work was actually in environmental education. I went to the School of Forestry at West Virginia University, which is where I won my blue ribbon in crosscut sawing.
Wow. And
often people think that's kind of a strange starting point for someone with such a love of history. But to me, if you think about this book, A Settler's Year, the people that we're talking about are people, every aspect of their life was dictated by the natural environment. And having that background, as I think about people who are moving here and living here, is just helpful for me to consider that and to imagine their experiences. So after getting my degree in environmental ed, I moved to Wisconsin, took a job at Old World Wisconsin because I think it's just an incredible historic site, and was fortunate enough to work there a dozen years, I think, altogether as an interpreter and for most of the time as curator. And during that time, I was practicing my writing. I always knew I wanted to write historical fiction and sometimes nonfiction as well. And as I said earlier, my first book that sold and flew was a young adult, so I've had the privilege of writing for children and then also the pleasure of writing somewhat more complex novels and also two nonfiction books that are largely aimed at adults.
Since we've talked about your other kinds of books you write, talk about the other books that were released this year. Well, one's due to be released soon. The other one was released in February.
That's right. The book that was released in February was a mystery that I wrote for American Girl. And over the past, I think, 16 or 17 years, I've done 19 books for American Girl. And those are all historical fiction about strong girls at different times in history. And I really learned to love history, especially as a child, because my parents made sure we got to the library a lot. And I read a lot of historical fiction. So it's quite a joy to pass some of that on in my own small way to young people today. And then the book that's coming out in just a few weeks is the sixth volume in a mystery series that I write called the Chloe Ellefson Mysteries. What happened is after I moved on from Old World, Wisconsin, I discovered that I really missed the historic sites world, and I missed having the opportunity to chat with visitors about their stories and the stories at the site. So I started this mystery series. Chloe Ellefson is a curator at, surprise, surprise, Old World, Wisconsin. And so that really got me back in touch. And some of the books are set there, but I often have Chloe in different books visit other historic sites in Wisconsin and occasionally other states in the upper Midwest. So I'm just having a marvelous time. It gives me the opportunity to share stories and places that I think are very special with readers. And I love it when I hear from readers who said, oh, my book group read your book, and then we all went out to Old World, Wisconsin, or we all went out to Rock Island to see the Pottawatomie Lighthouse, or things like that. That's been very, very rewarding.
Now, the Chloe Ellefson series isn't the most recent one following Laura Ingalls Wilder Across.
It is, yes. The book that's coming out in early October is called Death on the Prairie. Like many people I know, Laura Ingalls Wilder was one of the first novelists that I really fell in love with as a child, and her tales of life in Wisconsin and then farther west just captivated me as a child and really spurred my interest in history. So my sister and I, over the course of about 2 years, visited all of the home sites that are dedicated to Laura Ingalls Wilder. And after I completed that, I really felt that Chloe, my protagonist, needed to do the same thing. So in the book that's coming out, Chloe and her sister head off to visit all of the Laura Ingalls Wilder home sites, starting, of course, in Pepin, Wisconsin, where Laura was born.
Mm-hmm. There will be a book launch Sunday at the Old World, Wisconsin Historic Site near Eagle, Wisconsin, in Waukesha County, for the book A Settler's Year, Pioneer Life Through the Seasons. We've been talking to the author, Kathleen Ernst. Thanks so much for being with us.
I was delighted. Thanks for having me.
And remember, Jim's Conversations and all the Spectrum West programs in their entirety can be accessed online at WPR.org. Under Shows, you'll find Spectrum West, and you can listen. Many of our discussions are like a wonderful old cookbook casserole, just as good the second time around. Don't forget, remember last week we had Auntie Yarbala, who was a mandolin and contrabass player in the group Baltic Crossing, players from the UK, Finland, and Denmark. They're in Wisconsin. They perform tonight, if you're listening, Thursday at 7:30 p.m. at the West Denmark Parish Hall. That is just outside Luck, Wisconsin. And let's see, tomorrow night, September 18th, if you're listening Friday, that's tonight, 7:30 p.m., Barron Area Community Center in Barron. The website there is thebacc.com. In Luck, by the way, the tickets are available at the door. I'm Al Ross, and this is Spectrum West. Thanks so much for being with us today. See if we got a Spectrum memo. Can learn the skills to create a braided wool rug at the Chippewa Valley Museum in Eau Claire in October, three Saturdays, the 3rd, 17th, and 24th. Attend one or all three. Register by phone by September 21st or online at cvmuseum.com. Well, of all the things that might vault to the head of the culinary class, all the possibilities out there for becoming iconic and trendy and ultra-popular, who'd have thunk the social spotlight was going to shine on and consequently act as a warming agent for bacon. Yes, bacon. It's everywhere, including as the star of the third annual festival in River Falls, Wisconsin. It's so exciting and so animated, it's called a bash, the Bacon Bash. Judy Berg is Tourism Sales Marketing Manager for the River Falls Chamber of Commerce. And I had some questions. After only 2 years, you have some lofty ambitions. What happened during the first couple years that made you guys plant such powerful seeds designed to grow a beanstalk that climbs all the way up into the sky?
Well, I think because you have a food event themed around bacon. Very trendy. There's this whole bacon mania craze. We hit the timing just perfectly. It is a free, family-friendly event, and you tie in and add in some quirky, big theme activities, and it really just helps you host a truly spectacular event.
Take me back to the beginning. You had a meeting. Someone brought up the popularity of bacon, and the rest is history. Is that the way it went?
It went a little bit differently. We had our Bluegrass Festival in the springtime, and we're like, hey, that was a great event. What could we do to bring folks back in the fall?
Mm-hmm.
So we kind of brainstormed different foodie ideas. We had the Kinney River here, and we thought, gosh, fish would be a logical choice. So we kind of talked about some different things. My boss said pork. I said bacon. We did some research. We found out that bacon is an up-and-coming trendy festival so much that there is actually an International Bacon Day, which is the first Saturday after Labor Day. With that, we put our first event out there. It was intended to just be a preview event. We were hoping maybe 50 of our friends and family would show up. And lo and behold, we had nearly 4,000 folks attend our first year's event in 2013.
Wow. So how about 2014? How did that go? Much bigger?
It did, actually. With that, I had submitted a GEM grant application through the Wisconsin Department of Tourism, and we were awarded a sizable amount of money. So with that, we were able to put in place a very aggressive marketing campaign
mm-hmm.
that included ads in Midwest Living and various radio stations saturated throughout the Twin Cities and also throughout Wisconsin, including a recipe contest on Channel 3000 and things of that nature.
Wow.
And with that, and a group of very aggressive and hardworking volunteers and some wonderful generous sponsors and local businesses, last year's event, we hit nearly 10,000 people.
Wow.
We attended our 2014 Bacon Bash.
Were you prepared for 10,000 people?
Well, that's a really good question. Actually, when the different vendors asked me, hey, how many people are we expecting for this year's event? I forecasted that we would go probably from 4,000 maybe to 68,000. And after the first day's event, when I was told that we had nearly 6,500 people attend, I about fell off my chair.
Mm-hmm.
One story I can share with you is that the folks that had the maple bacon cheese curds, they ran out of their cheese curds within the first day, and they were actually able to reach out to one of the local businesses to actually replenish their supply the next day, and they ended up winning the People's Choice for the best food item that was actually sold at the 2014 Bacon Bash.
Now, the World Food Championships in Kissimmee, Florida is a big deal, and the River Falls event is a qualifier for it. Is it the first step, the only step? What kind of a step are you to the World Food Championships?
We are a super qualifying event, so what that means is that folks could actually compete in four different categories, bacon, chili, dessert, and sandwich. And then the top three winners in each of the four respective categories will receive a golden ticket to compete at the competition in Kissimmee, Florida. We are one of two super qualifying locations within the U.S., so we see that as a great honor. The other really wonderful thing is that the founder of the World Food Championship organization will actually be coming here to River Falls, facilitating the Food Champ class that will precede the Bacon Bash, and then he will also be overseeing the Super Qualifier event at the World Food Championship. So we're very excited and welcome his presence at our event.
We're talking with Judy Berg. She is Marketing Manager for the River Falls Chamber of Commerce, and this is the weekend. You can almost smell it already of the big River Falls Bacon Bash. It's September 19th and 20th, Saturday and Sunday. Now, there are several categories within which cooks, chefs, and kitchen hounds can compete You mentioned the four. Can you expound on them a little bit? Were you part of the World Food Championships in your first 2 years, or is this brand new?
We actually have been part of the World Food Championship in different capacities.
Okay.
But this year we have taken it up to the highest level that we can as far as being a super qualifier host site for the World Food Championship.
And judges, you were kind enough to see if I wanted to be a judge. Well, certainly I want to be a judge. It's just my schedule doesn't permit it. Does a judge have to taste everything, or you assigned to one category or what?
It's really up to you as far as what food category that you would be interested in judging. And mm-hmm. So you could pick one of the four or all four, depending upon how hungry that you are.
I had to host an event on Labor Day weekend, and that was just after International Bacon Day. It was September 5th, by the way, this year. For that event, I researched some things that people make, and I'll get to those in a minute. But, Judy, what has surprised you the most about people's creativity and how to use bacon?
Well, I'm really excited about the different food vendors who will be exhibiting at this year's event. We have really a variety of different food items. They kind of go from the breakfast items to, like, main entree kind of things, as well as to dessert. Here's an example. We have some bacon scones that will be provided, pig wings. We have bacon on a stick. We have bacon cheesecake, bacon fried rice. So all the yummy little different flavors that you can incorporate into bacon, whether it would be for breakfast, lunch, or dinner, mm-hmm. you'll be able to experience here at the Bacon Bash.
It depends on when people are listening. It could be Thursday or it could be Friday. Are either of those 2 days too late for somebody to get involved?
Not at all. We welcome all participants. We just want people to actually sign up at the event. Just come to the main stage, let us know your interest level, and we will get you signed up.
Okay. Now, as I said, International Bacon Day was September 5th. Some recipes make one suspect about how bacon will taste or how it might complement other ingredients, like there was a thing that I found called bacon jam. Maybe good on some things. But bacon, it turns out, is fairly universally good with other things. And some of the recipes I found include, and you probably have heard, I mean, you're hosting one of the biggest bacon bashes in America, so you probably heard of some of these. But maybe our audience has not. Bacon brownies.
Yes, and as a matter of fact, I had a chance to taste one at a recent taping at one of our local TV stations. It was very delicious, and not only was the actual bacon utilized with that, but also with the bacon fat.
Ooh.
Needless to say, I had a very small piece, but it was absolutely delicious.
Maple butter cream cupcakes with bacon sprinkles. Bacon sprinkles are probably huge.
Yeah, you do see that a lot, and we're planning to provide those for our volunteers. We have a great committee of volunteers helping us with the event, with the setup, tear down, and so on. So it's a little treat. We're going to provide those types of treats for them when they arrive.
Neat.
Saturday morning at 6 a.m.
This is radio, and I wish you could smell things because I think I'm starting to imagine it as I speak. Tough to visualize, but try to. These are called woven bacon taco shells, where people have taken strips of bacon and woven them, you know, like a basket into a taco shell. Man, now that sounds very good and utilitarian.
Very practical. We actually had a competitor compete in the baking category last year who did provide little baskets to the judges to, you know, judge against.
Ooh.
You know, as a regular attendee, didn't get a chance to taste it, but it looked absolutely delicious.
Mm-hmm. You are putting my name in the hat for next year, I hope.
Of course.
Okay, good. There's also bacon-wrapped sushi. That sounds smart.
Kind of seems like a contradiction of terms, though, doesn't it?
Kind of, but it's thin and it's long, so you could wrap something in it. A couple other things, chocolate almond bacon clusters. Bacon and chocolate, it's been determined, go well together.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, at this year's event, we are going to have sweet bacon almonds, and we are also going to have chocolate-covered bacon and maple bacon fudge. It does kind of really tie into that both individuals with the sweet tooth.
And here's one where bacon has infiltrated a long-standing favorite, bacon Rice Krispie treats.
Well, that one surprises me.
Is it? Bacon has notoriously been determined as being good with sweet things, hasn't it?
Yes. And I did want to mention, too, that we have Chef Augie from Le Cordon Bleu is going to be facilitating a cooking demonstration, and he's going to be doing exactly that. He's going to talk about, too, how and why bacon lends itself so, you know, nicely to certain meats, vegetables, sweets, and so on, too, to just kind of help provide kind of the educational and the background as far as how and why different foods fit so perfectly together.
Yep. This is one of those weekends where you can just throw caution to the wind and forget the fact that bacon just isn't the most healthy food in the world, but it sure is delicious.
Absolutely. Very tasty. Come to our event. You can really feel the flavor of River Falls, the flavor of the Bacon Bash, We just hope that people don't go home hungry.
Wonderful idea. A way to go. And I hope you guys, you know, meet your lofty goals. You'd like to become what? The largest bacon-centered festival in America?
We discovered that the Bacon Bash is now the second largest bacon festival in the nation. And we were surprised that it was only in a matter of 2 years that we were able to attract that many bacon lovers to our event. With this year's event, two things, with the super qualifying event that we have as host for the World Food Championship, and also with the advertising campaign that we have in place, again, targeting to the Twin Cities and throughout Wisconsin, we are hoping to become the nation's largest bacon festival.
Who do you have to leapfrog over to become largest?
Oh, it's just our friends in Iowa. Don't make me say their name.
Well, Iowa, sure. That would be a big coup if somebody in Wisconsin, you know, when it comes to pork and bacon, could supersede an Iowa festival. That would be wonderful.
All bacon festivals are very fun. It's just a very fun, trendy thing that people can experience. And you know, what really sets our event apart, again, is that because it is a free, family-friendly event with all the fun. It's got the bacon-inspired food booths, the different cook-offs, the various contests, the different food items are really intended to be shared. We welcome all folks to River Falls, and we're also expected to have beautiful weather this weekend, so we're very excited about that as well.
Being family-friendly, what is there for kids to do?
We have pig culling and pig impersonation contests. People are encouraged to dress up their pets. Everyone's also invited to come in costume. We also have, you know, a t-shirt contest. And then there are going to be over 200 plush pigs that are going to be flung from the rooftop with various prizes, plastic pigs flung off the bridge. All of them have different numbers tied to the prizes. And then we also have the kids' cook-off competition, and we also have a kids' eating contest, and that will consist of bacon-infused mac and cheese.
I can see kids devouring that.
That would be very fun and very delicious.
Judy, thanks so much, and have a good time. I hope we have a westerly wind so that people to the east of River Falls can smell the big bacon bash.
We would welcome that.
The website is riverfallsbaconbash.com. By the way, Judy wasn't willing to say it, but the largest festival is Blue Ribbon Bacon Fest in Des Moines, Iowa. Come on, let's put bacon where our mouth is. Let's beat those guys. This is Spectrum West. Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from Simply Done in Downsville, offering fair trade gifts and a space for meetings, retreats, or classes in their historic schoolhouse overlooking the Red Cedar Valley. Simply-dunn.com. Jim Oliver's back with what's on stage at Western Wisconsin.
Thanks, Al. The Old Gem Theater in New Richmond will present Johnny Appleseed for groups, opening Monday and running weekdays through October 16th. Making God Laugh, a production of the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson, will run Fridays through Sundays through September 27th. The St. Croix Off-Broadway Dinner Theater Musical Review Pop-Up Musical will run Fridays and Saturdays through October 24th at the theater in Hudson. The Eau Claire Children's Theater will hold auditions for Alice in Wonderland at 5:30 p.m. Sunday and Monday at the Oxford Theater. The Children's Theater will also have auditions for Chitty Chitty Bang Bang at 7 p.m. Sunday and Monday. That's some of what theater companies are doing around Western Wisconsin. For Spectrum West, I'm Jim Oliver.
You know, we're only days away from the official start of autumn, but already there are Oktoberfests like the one in Chippewa Falls this weekend and autumn art tours. One such art tour is the 6th annual Fall Splendor Art Meander next Friday through Sunday, September 25th through 27th. Mary Gladich is a participant, and she had details for us.
I have been fortunate to get involved with Patricia Hamm, a very wonderful artist who lives in Chautauqua.
Yep.
And she and a few other artists had this idea. They knew several artists and started in 2009. And I happened to get involved, I think, 3 or 4 years ago now. It's been a wonderful experience and just really a lot of fun.
Now, because you had the mettle to endure a radio interview, you get to tout your location. It's called Lodestar Gallery and features watercolor and mixed media. You are on a lake. Tell us about it.
Well, my gallery started in 2011 when I retired from teaching fourth grade for a number of years. I have really probably my entire life been It's difficult to call oneself an artist, but I'm going to say, yes, I am an artist. And one of the ways in which I was able to start having shows and have a gallery is my husband built a garage, and it has a lovely loft, and that's where my gallery is.
Cool.
And it's right on the lake, right on Heard Lake, a small lake that is connected to Long Lake. It's a beautiful setting, and I guess that's true for so many of these places. It makes this tour really fascinating because it's not just the art, it's also the places. There's just a lot of really nice places to visit.
So what's with the name, Lodestar Gallery?
Well, you know those little pads that you get where you learn a word a day kind of thing?
Sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, it was the year I retired, and Lodestar was in there, and it had to do with one who inspires. So that's what I went with.
Well, while we're on definitions, meander, if you look it up, means to follow a winding course, which you have. Originally, it meant to wander aimlessly, but this this meander has objectives to it. So why don't you go ahead and fill us in and fill in the blanks on the other locations who are in this art meander?
Well, I would love to. One of the things that is unique about this tour is that it spans about a one-hour drive, no matter where you start. And, of course, you can start anywhere between Bloomer and Spooner or any town in between that is involved.
Okay.
I will start you off in Bloomer at the O'Neill Creek Winery. There will be five artists there and music, so it's a great place to start. He makes all his own wines, and there will be lots of art there as well. And then from there, you can move to New Auburn, where my gallery is located.
Okay.
On your way north, it's just about 20 miles. And the next town that you would come to would be Clayton, Blue Moon Botanicals. She does some very, well, this hand-stamped jewelry using mixed metals, which is really in style right now, and that's kind of her feature art. But she also makes wax candles and interesting things. Her gallery is located on her front porch. And Chautauqua has several artists, Patricia Hamm at Art Innovations. Nancy Erickson Dutmer and Don Olson are also in Chautauqua. C.J. Connor, who is an amazing realistic artist, she's in Chautauqua. And they're fairly close together, so that would be a really good place to go. At Patricia Hamm's place, she will have three guest artists there this year, really something to see. And so the nice thing about this is even though there's 15 galleries, it's representing, I don't know how many, hundreds of artists, literally, because mm-hmm. some of the places have quite a few artists represented there. So.
Okay.
And just north of there is Cameron, the Olive Branch Gallery. Janice Morris and her husband, Dan, have a gallery and a frame shop there. She has studied and traveled all over the United States with a really amazing artist, and she herself has won several awards and got lots of really cool things to show. After Cameron is Rice Lake, Paulette Bundich. She does beautiful jewelry using semi-precious stones. After Rice Lake, you can head to Cumberland is the Dancing Bird Art Studio and Music Shop, and you definitely you don't want to miss that one. And then, of course, the Potter's Shed in Shell Lake, which has just an amazing garden, 5,000 square feet of beautiful outdoor art, lots of pottery, and over 200 artists represented at that place. Then the Brickyard. So many of these places are just, they're very unique settings, and the Brickyard is particularly unique. It is built in an old brick schoolhouse, and it features the pottery and the glasswork of Mary and Brian Doche. And then again, lots of other artists. And then in Spooner is the Purple Pelican Gallery, and that's owned by Issa Everode, and she has, again, a unique building. She lives above in a loft apartment, which is very unique. And during the Art Meander, she offers tours. And so people can view that. It's Spooner on Walnut Street. It's a really funky little street that has lots of interesting shops, things to see and do. And the Northwind Book and Fiber is also there. And another unique place that has just started in 2013 is the Arts in Hand Gallery. And that has been developed for visiting artists from all around who can sell their works there. That's kind of a quick flurry. I'd like to say more about each, but it's really awesome. You can take in as much or, you know, you can pick and choose.
Well, I think what you did is, in one word, described the feeling of the Fall Splendor Art Meander, and that is funky. I like that.
Well, you know, it is. You know, because I'm in the tour, I don't get to do the tour.
Mm-hmm.
So I had the pleasure of taking my brochures that were printed and actually doing the tour. And I just thought, this is just an incredible venture. And I guess the other thing I would like to mention is we have had some great sponsors that, you know, support us financially in terms of getting signage and brochures, and Layman's Supper Club in Rice Lake and the Tower House in Cumberland, and also Culver's has supported us.
There will be Meander signs, I see, on your website.
They're bright yellow and they say Art Meander. People can watch for those as they travel about.
So it's art, it's fun, it's food, and it's cheer. That's a word that is also used on your website.
Absolutely. And many of the places will be offering some type of refreshment. So just adds to the fun. Food and beverages always make everything a little more exciting.
Fall Splendor Art Meander, it's the sixth annual. What is your website?
It is www.art-meander.com.
And it's a colorful website. Mary Gladich, thanks for being with us on Spectrum West.
Thank you so much for having me.
By the way, the hours are next Friday the 25th, noon to 6, Saturday from 10 to 5, and Sunday from 10 to 4. Art tours going on in West Wisconsin include this weekend's Rustic Road 13 pottery event and sale on a farmstead near Hudson. 13 area ceramic artists featured, a portion of sales donated to Second Harvest Heartland. That event is Saturday from 10 to 6 and Sunday from 11 to 5. Details and a map online at rusticroad13pottery.com. Also this weekend, the second Yellowstone Art Trail Art Tour from 10 to 6 in the Cadott, Boyd, and Stanley areas. 36 artists and 19 locations. Details at yellowstonearttrail.blogspot.com. And there are more coming in October as well. Friday evening, don't forget, it's the music and photos of John Mock, called From Sea to Shore, as the new Flambeau Valley Arts season kicks off in Ladysmith. Hey, thanks, Hannah Severson, Debbie Brown, and Dean Kallenbach for sending good signals and catching our pitches. Thank you for being the audience, for sharing your time with us. Next week, we're going to return to sitting around the farm table, and you should hear what else we're working on. And you will if you come back next week, same time. We'll all be waiting. Thanks again. I'm Al Ross.